Session number 22353, Reel 9.
Eric Warburton, Reel 9.
This was before the 94th mood I was sent up, and to get this, whatever equipment I could acquire, is the right word, I think. The Army have a peculiar name of purloining and all sorts of things. But anyway, and I came away with a microscope and all the equipment for dealing with the slides and deciding what was what, and to diagnosing what the difficulty was in that particular field. And so, this, taking this back to the hospital, the hospital as we now knew it, that was our own setup in this school in Lüneburg. I was I set up my own room. Where, of course, I interviewed all the patients, and then we had three other rooms which had accommodation for the patients themselves and for a place where they were treated by some other of the chaps. My job, of course, was to diagnose after having do the tests. That is, take smears, cook them, and then put them under this microscope and decide that, obviously, by reading that microscope, whether they had the early stages of venereal disease or otherwise. And and every morning I had to gather the people that were in overnight for syphilis and they're wanting their further treatment, and we sent off the ambulance off to Hamburg to the 94th General, who could deal with them in that severe state. We only dealt with the gonorrhea people.
What were the proportions of age?
Oh, I should think that the greater proportion were with gonorrhea. The syphilis ones were retention doses or whatever, because that's quite a different kettle of fish to straightforward gonorrhea. And we went on the work increased, and it was quite surprising. The paperwork, of course, was quite something as well. Insofar that it was a sort of done in quadruplicate, and copy of the report would go to the German police, the English police records, and it was a serious business, and so the paperwork, etc., got a bit not out of hand, but it certainly was taking up far too much time. And so I was, it was suggested that I had some assistant to, and this was the purpose of the exercise they applied to the local chappy who was dealing with the civilian employment, which was a British chap. And along came two candidates, two lady candidates. I was under the bench. I mean, I didn't see an MO at all. I ran this entirely on my own. But in this case, I asked for some MO to come in and sit in. And so he took up his position behind the desk, and in came the first one, who was blonde, spoke English, and she was very knowledgeable. And she told us that she was a radiographer, and that she knew all about VD, etc. After the interview, she went out, and we had the second girl in, who was the daughter of an Estonian doctor, but we didn't know that bit at the time. And so she came in. She could not speak a word of English, but she knew what to do with by asking her, did she know how to do this or that or the other, and she knew. And she was very willing to work. And so, and she was a dark-haired girl, and very nice. And so she went. They both. Then she went out. And the MO said to me, "What? What do you think?" And I said, "The blonde terrifies me." So we had the other one. So the dark-haired girl, Maria.
In what way did she terrify you?
Oh, she was so overpowering, and she knew it all. And as she spoke English as well, it made it that it was quite difficult. So the MO agreed, and so we had Maria. And she started. She came the next day to start work, and she brought sheets of foolscap paper with the German names of various things on one column, and with the English alternative alongside them. So she was, she came and she did the job that we were asked her to do very well. That is that I did the investigation and the diagnosis, and she did. Once I'd taken a smear, I handed it to her, and she would then prepare it so it was ready for the microscope, and I would then read it and come to a decision as to what was the matter. So that was how it went on, and it went from strength to strength, and it was really a big business because we had not only serving population, servicemen, we also had civilians being brought in by the German police because they were trying to control this situation, which of course was very difficult. At the same time, it was the weather, of course, was now was deep snow. We had the pleasure of seeing horse-drawn sleighs and things of that nature, and then there was always the colourful St. Nicholas processions on the 6th of November, and there was plenty to occupy our time with if one got out. Personally, I used to work from 8 o'clock until 1 o'clock, then leave the clinic was virtually closed then. We weren't likely to get any more clients that morning, so then I used to go playing badminton in the afternoon until 4:30, 5 o'clock, and then after I would go back and work in the evening. I'd catch up with all the paperwork up till about 10 o'clock, or how long it took. So that was the life at Lüneburg, which I rather fancied. A lot of the chaps were now already on their way home, and and each month they would come to me and say, "Can you stay another month, or will you stay another month?" Because we haven't got anybody to replace you. And so I thought this was a good idea, and so I continued. Hence, I didn't come home till quite well into 1946. My age and service number, which was the governing factor as to when your demob came up, was 27, which meant that I should have been home many, many months beforehand. In fact, I think 27 would have allowed me to come home almost immediately the war finished, I should think. But there I was, and I had grave doubts about coming home. Situation being that I calculated that if a person of 14, of course 14 was the time then that one started work, had begun a trade or a profession or whatever, they were now, 7 years later, filling all the positions that there were available. And what would I do? So I might as well stay in the army. And this was very foremost in my mind, and I was quite happy to let it rest there. And I was very surprised one morning. The colonel never came into my domain, but on this occasion he came in. And there was just Maria and myself in the room, and he was quite pleasant, and then he said, "Don't you think you ought to go home?" Nobody had ever mentioned to me about going home at all previously, and so it came a bit of a shock. And he followed it up by saying, "Your papers are ready on my desk. Pick them up. Catch some transport to get you to Hanover tonight, and you're on your way home." This was a very, the expression, I have that same feeling now. I can just imagine it happening. And he said, "Cheerio," that was it. And
what was your feeling exactly?
I wasn't sure that I wanted to come home. I was very happy in what I was doing. I was quite happy to stay. For as long as they let me stay, I was quite happy to stay. But I'd had one or two letters from home, of course, which said, "Why aren't you coming home? Everybody else seems to be coming home." And so I just accepted the situation, I suppose. And anyway, it was an instruction from the CO. And that was it. His word was law, as far as I was concerned. I was a soldier. And an instruction from an officer, and my senior officer, was enough for me to act upon it and gather my things together. Well, I had been in charge of a room and a billet, and so I had gone and gathered my stuff up. And it went round this hospital amongst the civilian staff, which there were many, like lightning. And I had to take my blankets and things along to the store. And as I went along with my bags eventually, there were all these civilian people lining the corridor of this school where we were in, and saying goodbye to, as they termed it, Grocer Brewer. They all used to call me Grocer Brewer. And
Grocer Brewer?
Yeah. Brother. Grocer, big brother, if you like. And because I'd been, I suppose, so kind to them all, and it was quite incredible. One of the other jobs it was a situation I did, was that the protection of the guardian of the dangerous drugs, which were under a lock and key, and these were in another room, which was the chiropodist's room. And so I stayed, and I slept in the chiropodist room, and obviously wakened up if it was necessary by a DR or somebody coming in for some of these drugs, and I had to control that. A German lady used to come in and clear and clean the room up in the morning, ready for the Chiropodist sessions to take place. But during our stay in that situation, Maria said that she was interested in doing investigating dirty water, so amoeba and us and things of that nature were the things. So she had me going down into the local park and breaking the ice and getting a sample of water, which we brought back, and then we analysed it and we did a necessary. And I still have her notes in my book over there, my Pew's manual, which I've still got with me, and there are her notes in there. Oh yes, in there. So anyway, I found myself hitting a lift to Hanover, and I then got a train from Hanover and got myself down to Calais, I think, yes, Calais. And then from Calais we came over to catch the train at Dover. Dover took me, the train took us, well, I say took me, yes, and all the rest, was on the train up to York. That was an awful long way around the country, as it were. It seemed to go everywhere. And eventually we arrived at York. And then I went through this sort of machine-like process of being demobbed. And almost like the same as being kitted out in the first day I entered the army. There was, you know, you selected an overcoat and a trilby hat, I remember, and whatever. And so on my way home, a very peculiar feeling, because I realised that I got to get a job when I got home, and how does one go about getting a job in those sort of situations, which I had had envisaged. So eventually I arrived with these parcels, etc., but still in my army uniform, which I liked, and arrived at my home, only to be told that my wife, I did send a telegram home to say that I was coming home, but I arrived to be told that my wife, I got fed up with waiting, and she'd gone to the cinema across the road. We lived on the outskirts of Derby at this time, Cherry Tree Hill, and there was just a park across the road, and it's a cinema, and then there's a pub, and it's really all sort of village-like. So I went across to the cinema, and I said to the manager, "I've just come home, and my wife's in here." So he said, "Does she know?" Well, I said, "I sent a telegram, but she got fed up with waiting." So he said, "You've literally just got home." I said, "Yeah, wait here." He said, "I'll put it on the screen that she's wanted outside." So I said, "How much?" "I just want to see her face when she comes out." And so that's how I came home and met up with my good lady again. And that was in 1946. So she wasn't very particularly keen to see me in my uniform still. And so I think that was the next thing was to sort of get that uniform off, you're no longer a soldier type of thing, and that didn't go down terribly well, because I was really put out to be a soldier.
What was her attitude towards the army?
very bad. She didn't like the fact that I'd been away so long, and she didn't like the fact that I'd been exposed, I suppose, to these situations. And she wouldn't have anything at all to it. In fact, I lost my uniform very, very quickly, as far as that's concerned. I think after about a couple of weeks, when I managed to wear my uniform on a couple of occasions, I think that was the last, and she dispensed with that.
Why did she adopt his attitude?
I'm sorry?
Why did she adopt his attitude?
I don't know, and she remained like that all her life. She has never wanted to know anything at all about what I did, what was, what was my feelings about the army. She didn't want to know. For instance, my medals came one day in the post, and she didn't want to know anything about them. She also didn't do anything at all about mounting them on my bar, as it were. And it was only just a few years ago that Anne put my medals, she said, "I'll do them for you, because you want to go to these various functions." And I said, "Yes, I do." And
So was it because your wife was a pacifist?
No, I don't know what prevented her from being quite pleased about the fact that I'd been a serving soldier. I don't know. It was just one of those things. And so I've entered in the last, maybe a bit more than 6 years than now, I've entered into the spirit of doing these various things, and see, as a result, I then became involved with the NVA, and more especially with the MGVA, that is the Market Garden Veterans Association. But anyway, to get a job was a bit of a problem. I decided that I would go to. I got a friend actually who was the chief probation officer in Derby, and so he said, "Tell you what, you come and help me, and in your spare time," which I did. And eventually, I went down to the Home Office and had an interview there for becoming a probation officer. And they said, "Yes, whatever the training that you're doing at the moment, it will be quite satisfactory, and we will send you in due time to college, and you will be able to go take up the career of a probation officer." But unfortunately, shortly afterwards, the government decided that they would not be taking any more people unless they were postgraduates and had a degree. And so they wrote to me and said, "We're sorry, but we will not be able to take you into the service." So that was a bit of a shock, and so that was that. In the meantime, I had been doing a job which my father had got me in the carriage and wagon works, and which I had turned into, because they had so many accidents, I turned myself into their medical orderly, or at least their ambulance man, and I spent more time in that part of the job than anything else. And so it was, to my amazement, really, that I went home one night and my wife said, "There's a job that you can do in the paper. Do you want to know about this?" Yeah. And I looked at this job and I said, they want a draftsman and they want an estimator. I can't do that. She said, well, I don't understand. If you don't know what you can do, and this is a job which you're supposed to have some pieces of paper which says you can do it, which was what I was doing before the war, going to college, etc. So I wrote to Sharp Brothers and Knight and offered my services, and then and nothing happened. And a fortnight later, the same advert came in the paper again, and it said, "Would the previous applicants reapply?" And I was quite niggled about this, and I said, "Well, that's no good. That's not no good going to that company. They are short of tuppence halfpenny stamps, because I sent a stamp to Dunstan Way." And so after some niggling, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, I to appease my wife, I said, "Oh, right." So I wrote again, and got an interview with his company, an interview which took 2 hours. It was a most interesting interview. I saw this man who was the assistant to the managing director. Well, I was head of department, actually. And so he said, took me into the drawing office and said, could I do this, could I do that? And so, obviously, I said, well, yes, I can. And then he took me into their estimating office, and he said, can you take off? Can you take this? And so I said, yes, I suppose so. In actual fact, I'd taken a course during the war with the College of Estate Management on quantities, so I had a piece of paper from them as well. And so he said, eventually, after a long time, he said, you don't sound very sure of yourself. I said, mister, I've just done 7 years in the army. If you had been in the same situation, would you be as confident as you appear to think that I should be? Oh, I don't know. And I said, well, I tell you what I'll do. What time do you start work tomorrow morning? So he said, 8:30. I said, right. And what time do you finish work? Oh, whatever time it was, 5:00. So I said, well, I will come and work for you tomorrow morning and all day, that being Thursday. And I will return on Friday. And if by Friday afternoon you think I'm suitable for the job and I like it here, we'll do a deal. And he said, oh, I don't know about that. He said, you'll have to see Mr. Sharp. And so I said, all right. And he took me back all through this. Over 400 people were employed at this place. And it had a central roadway went up through it as part of the workshop complex. So he took me in and he said, you'd better wait out here while I go in. And so he went in and saw Mr. Sharp, and eventually I was called in. Mr. Sharp was a wonderful chap, really. He had an enormous glass table top. I think it must have been about 8 foot by 8 foot or something of that nature. And he sat at the opposite side and he said, I understand that you've made me an offer. So I said, yes. So he said, in all my working life, I've never been made an offer like that at all. I'm going to take you on. I said, well, thank you very much. And he said, how long have you been here? And I said, 2 hours or more. So he said, well, you want a cup of tea before you go back home then? So I said, Yes. Very nice. So he said, right. So he rang up for and pressed a button, obviously, and he said to this company secretary, Eastope, bring half a crown down here. So Eastope comes in, very gently putting this, and he slung this